Fighting Through Podcast, Episode 68, Leslie Cook, Part 5, Burma. More Grace on Published History. Two of the attackers had occupied an abandoned weapon pit on a mound above and behind me, less than 3 metres away. I could hear them, but I couldn't see them. The rain was pouring down and the night was pitch black. I suddenly became aware that something was moving in the jungle alongside the track about 10 metres in front of me. It was a stealthy sound of someone or something trying to move quietly. I switched the change lever on the Bren from safety to automatic and ensured that my grenades were at hand. I was forward scout on the patrol. This is a position where one moves very warily, being careful not to make any sound or rapid movement, and at the same time keeps a watchful eye on the area in front. Even leaves turned back to front is an alarm signal. Hello again, and another warm World War II welcome to the Fighting Through Second World War podcast. I'm Paul Cheel, son of Bill Cheel, whose World War II memoirs have been published by Pen and Sword in Fighting Through from Dunkirk to Hamburg. The aim of this podcast is to give you the stories behind the story. You'll hear memoirs and interviews of veterans in all the countries and all the forces. I dare you to listen. Today, we're going to continue with a final instalment in the Les Cook series, moving over to Burma and the end of his war, with tales from 1945 to 46. This is probably going to be quite a long episode, so tighten your helmet straps. It's going to be a good one. And I've got a PS which, at many levels, you definitely do not want to miss. Remember, with a Fighting Through podcast, the action and interest is not over till I say bye-bye now. I'm going straight into a family story now from listener Gabriel Cervantes. Gabriel wrote in with impeccable timing for this episode, as you're about to find out. Hello, Paul. I just discovered your show this past week, and I love it. Good man, Gabriel. My father, his two brothers, and my mum's two brothers, all first-generation American boys of Mexican-born parents, were all in the army during the war. My dad served in the Philippines in the last month of the war and was part of the occupation of Japan. I fortunately sat him down and wrote down most of his experiences during the war. His younger brother was shot by a German wearing an American uniform. He survived the war and must have been a forgiving person because over the years he probably owned 15 Volkswagens. Gabriel Cervantes, Appleton, Wisconsin. And Gabriel has followed up with a few pics of his family history, which I've put in the show notes on the website at fightingthroughpodcast.co.uk. So here we go. As kindly supplied by Gabriel, the Pacific War Service of his dad, Private First Class Antonio Y. Cervantes of the United States Army. I was originally drafted before Pearl Harbor, but ended up 4F, unfit for military service, because of flat feet and a hernia operation. But the draft board called me back in November 1944. A girl named Betty was a customer of our small grocery store, and she worked for the draft board. My mother went to her and tried to talk her out of taking me, as my two brothers were already in the army. Betty felt bad. She tried to explain that she was just working there. I told Betty to ignore my mother. I did boot camp in Camp Hood, Texas. It was cold and miserable. The company across from us was shipped off to fight in the Battle of the Bulge. Even though I think the Texans were still fighting the Alamo and didn't like us Mexicans, they left me alone. I did what I was told and made the best of it. After boot camp, we got 2 weeks' leave and then reported to Fort Ord, California. were left from San Francisco aboard the USS General A.E. Anderson. We were at sea about 45 days, with a stop in New Guinea on the way to Manila. There were 6,000 of us on board. The ship was rolling, and I was sicker than a dog. I was on guard duty one night and was caught asleep on watch. I argued with the sergeant who found me, and I claimed I'd been awake. I was still put in the brig for one day. While on ship, we heard President Roosevelt had died, and later on that the Germans surrendered. We arrived in Manila and were there for one day. It was miserable there, really hot. We boarded another ship and went to Leyte. We were there about 2 weeks working details and digging near the airstrip. There we saw the P-61 Black Widow night fighters. Listener, there's a pic in the show notes. After that we were shipped to Mindanao. There I saw a GI with a hammer, and I asked another guy what was that about. He said that the Japs had gold fillings, and this guy would use the hammer to knock their teeth out. We were there for maybe a day, and then we were ordered down a dirt road to meet our company. On the side of the road was a creek, and on a mound next to the creek were about 20 dead Japanese. There were flies everywhere. The guy I was with said, "Look at that," but I just kept my eyes straight ahead. We found our company, and I got a foxhole with another private who'd been in Mindanao a while. The first thing I saw was an arm sticking out from underneath the dirt nearby. I asked about it, and he said that was one of the Japanese who'd tried to infiltrate the night before. I forget that GI's name. At night we sure talked a lot about women while in that foxhole. One night we were too loud because a sergeant called out, "Quiet, you SOBs, or I'll come over there and shut you up." A few days after we'd got there, I was on a patrol. A couple of GIs ahead of me passed by a piece of corrugated steel leaning next to a tree. A corporal we called Lindy came up to us, pulled back the corrugated steel, and exposed a Japanese soldier standing behind it. And he killed him. Later on that same patrol, while walking in single file, we suddenly heard yelling from 6 or 7 shirtless, unarmed Japanese charging at us, head-on. A BAR man, Browning automatic rifle, with us, shot them all with one burst. The rest of us never got a shot off. Our sergeant said, "Let's get the hell out of here," and we turned around and went back. I could hear the moans of the Japanese for quite a distance while heading back. One morning, just as I was waking up, I heard a pop and someone yelled, "Mortar!" Later, while heading for the chow line, I saw 2 bodies covered with ponchos. All I could see was their boots. I asked what the heck happened there, and someone explained, "You know that mortar this morning? It fell right in their foxhole. One was lying down, and the other was sitting up, stretching, when it hit them. It had hit 2 foxholes over from mine." Another time, we were on a push behind 3 tanks. I heard an explosion and didn't think about it. I figured it was a gun from a tank. A day or two later, a friend named Estrada from Silver City, New Mexico, saw me and said, "You know, Tony, I'm glad to see you. I saw a Jap on a suicide run running towards one of those tanks with a box of explosives over his head, and I thought you were dead." That was the explosion I'd heard. I was woken up one night to serve watch by a GI from a heavy weapons company that had come to share our foxhole. I noticed the silhouette of someone crawling on all fours towards me. I asked the GI, "Hey, what's that?" The GI said, "Don't shoot, he's one of ours." He was coming back from taking a leak. The next day, someone was cussing out that guy I'd seen crawling, pointing towards me and saying, "You're lucky he didn't shoot you." He was right. There were some trigger-happy GIs there. One time, a couple of GIs were with a Filipino Moro, a Muslim inhabitant of the Philippines, who was holding a canvas bag. The guys wanted me to look in the bag. I wouldn't look because they told me that inside were the heads of three Japanese. Ouch. Once we were ordered to clean up, as General MacArthur was going to pay us a visit. We waited and waited and waited, but that so-and-so never showed up. We were in a mopping-up stage, so that's all the action I saw. Then we started training for the invasion of Japan. At the time, I didn't give it a thought. I wasn't even afraid. Looking back on it, I probably would have been killed in Japan. We were sitting on cut-down palm tree trunks, watching a movie, when someone came in and said that an atomic bomb had been dropped on Hiroshima. Then, a week later, we heard about Nagasaki. When the war was over, some guys went crazy and were shooting their guns off at night by the beach. An officer stopped them, yelling, "Don't you SOBs know there are still Japs out there?" In October 1945, we shipped out to Shikoto, Japan. About 7 months later, me and another GI were ordered to Nagasaki. We took a train. The countryside was nice and green. In Japan, we took it easy. We were well fed and there was no training. I had a local woman doing my laundry. I'd take her ice cream. There were these two GIs, Quigley from Santa Monica and Snyder from Pasadena. We were all from Southern California and got along real good. They had this box. I thought it was a camera. Later they showed me a bunch of cigarettes in it. They were selling the cigarettes on the black market to the Japanese and asked me if I wanted in. None of us three smoked, so we made some good money. On Christmas Day 1945, me and three GIs were pulling guard duty on this building. I remember hearing Silent Night. Inside it was loaded with all kinds of samurai swords. Someone told us to take our pick, but I didn't. Another time we were on a landing craft dumping Japanese rifles in the ocean. Again, somebody said to help ourselves. This time I took a rifle in a wooden box and I gave it to my brother Carlos when I got home. In November 1946, they told me I was going home. I was packing up my things and a GI from Colorado coaxed me into taking his samurai sword. He didn't want it and neither did I, but I ended up taking it home. We took a boat to Seattle. Someone told us it was cold there and that we should wear our ODs. I think that's olive drab, warmer clothing, as opposed to KD khaki drill for hot weather. Even though it was November, it wasn't cold. It was beautiful there. I remember they gave us apple pie and milk. From there, we took a train to San Francisco and then home to Colton. The first meal I asked my mother to make for me was fried rabbit. We used to sell rabbit at the store and I wanted that more than anything else. I went back to work in the store. Like I said, it was just a mopping up stage. I didn't see as much combat as other guys. I never even fired my M1. I didn't have any trouble adjusting back to civilian life, no nightmares or anything like that. I feel more bothered by what happened on September the 11th by anything I saw in the war. The only problems were two relapses of malaria over the years. As told to Gabriel Cervantes, November the 5th, 2001. Gabriel, that is a great story and fantastic work by you to take the initiative on recording his memories. So thank you for that. And your dad may have ended up not firing his gun, but he was clearly in great danger at times. And Gabriel, you also sent me a few photos of your dad's, including from Japan, which I've posted in the show notes. It's funny how many aspects of that story throw light on other stuff we've heard about or da-da-da-da-da we're about to hear about, so keep your ears peeled for the rest of the show. I can only add one more thing, and we've not had one of these for a while, and that's to say, how good is that? Thanks again, Gabriel. I'm not sure what I've been on this morning, but I think I might have had one or too many Calvados, and that's Sydney Top's fault, because Sydney wrote in and said, "I've been listening to your show for about a year now, and I've listened to many of your episodes multiple times. I love your show. Your dad was an amazing man. My granddad, Henry Topf, served as an American soldier during World War II, most significantly during the Battle of the Bulge. My father, Henry Sonny Topf, followed in his footsteps and served in the US Air Force during Vietnam. I followed my father, but into the army, and served for 24 years. I'm proud to say that my son Shane has chosen to continue service and is currently in medical school as an army lieutenant. How great is that? I've met many lovely folks from your great country while participating in the 71st, 74th and 75th D-Day anniversaries. Currently, I lead cadets to Normandy during the D-Day anniversary where they participate in the event. Please keep up the great work. Now, Sydney kindly bought me far too many Calvados through the Buy a Coffee feature on the website. So many that if I was going to drink them all, I'd never be allowed anywhere near the Dakota that he parachuted from in the video he sent me. Off my word. There's a link to that in the show notes along with a few brilliant family war history photos. Thanks so much for all that, Sydney." Hey. Before I forget, Sydney did tell me he's from Alaska. Over to the main event. Australian Leslie Eric Cook was in the 2nd of the 14th, and he served in Greece, Crete, New Guinea, Borneo and Japan. The Borneo Campaign of 1945 was the last major Allied campaign in the Southwest Pacific area during World War II to liberate Japanese-held British Borneo and Dutch Borneo. Amphibious assaults were conducted by the Australians against the Japanese forces who'd been occupying the island since 1941. The Australian ground forces were supported by US and other Allied forces, with the US providing the bulk of the shipping and logistics support necessary to conduct the operation. So here's the next instalment of Les's memoirs. This one's called The Funny Side. Some wartime situations, however serious, also have their bizarre and even humorous side, mostly in retrospect, of course. We'd driven the enemy from a hill that dominated the immediate area, and we expected him to make a serious effort to regain it. He didn't disappoint us, but for some extraordinary reason restricted himself to night attacks only, leaving us in peace during the days. We had two platoons from Don Company and one from C Company, less than 100 men all told. A carrying party with food and ammunition had got through to us just before last light on the first day, and several of our people were away from their positions collecting supplies. It was almost dark when two men carrying their rifles and bayonets at the high port appeared in front, walking slowly towards us. Because of their casual manner, and because some of our people were still moving about inside the perimeter, their appearance didn't ring any immediate alarm bells. Listener, high port means, like, crossbody. They came towards us, paused for a few seconds and spoke to each other, then turned and started to walk away. Seeing this, my section leader called, "Hey!" They stopped and turned to face the sound of his voice, then turned back and continued to walk away. Gibby called again, "You're going the wrong way!" They stopped again and were looking back when one of our people, who must have had a better view of them, suddenly called, "It's the honourable men! Let them have it!" and immediately opened fire. Within seconds we became aware that they were all around us, and indeed had actually entered our perimeter in some places, without us even knowing they were there. There was pandemonium for a while until the thing sorted itself out and we could ascertain who was on which side. Fortunately for us, They were even more confused than we were. Although they must have lived in the area, they didn't seem to know where they were. We also had the added advantage that we were dug in, whereas they were in the open. They mounted a serious attack soon after and continued to attack at intervals throughout the next 2 nights. Their first attack carried them right into our positions and was almost successful. In the rush, two of them had occupied an abandoned weapon pit on a mound above and behind me, and less than 3 meters away. I could hear them, but couldn't see them. The rain was pouring down, and the night was pitch black. There was no visibility. If I used a grenade, it would probably roll back on me before exploding. If I fired at them, there was almost no chance of success, but an absolute certainty that the flash would disclose my presence and result in instant retribution. I think it's called being on the horns of a dilemma. One thing was certain, I wasn't going to be of much use to anybody while they were there, so close to my right shoulder. To prevent being placed in this awkward situation again, I moved my gun into a weapon pit on the mound the following day. Sometime later, our command post was able to contact the Navy by radio, and one of the ships fired star shells above us so we could see what was happening. Each shell turned the night into day with an eerie blue light for several seconds before burning out, thus enabling us to restore some semblance of order. We'd been warned that the star shells were coming, but of course they came as a complete surprise to the enemy. When the first shell burst above us, my unwelcome neighbours departed in indecent haste before I could do anything about them, thus solving the problem for me. I've no doubt that when they realised the situation they'd been in, they were as pleased to be gone as I was to see them go. The Japanese at war are noisy people. Preceding each attack, they often blew whistles or bugles and shouted amongst themselves. In this particular place, they'd form up in some dead ground about 30 meters in front of us, and when ready, they'd noisily wind themselves up and charge. We'd successfully repelled several attacks in the pouring rain on that first night, but our future was starting to look a bit doubtful. We were surrounded and outnumbered. Our ammunition was running low, and we couldn't withstand another really determined attack. Time was running out for us. It must have been about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning when they were forming up again and carrying on with their shouting preparatory to attacking, that we heard an Australian voice call, "If yous are going to have a go, don't stand there all night talking about it." This unexpected call from our side obviously threw the enemy into some confusion. They immediately lapsed into silence, apparently trying to work out the significance to them of this one strange cry. I never found out who was responsible. Perhaps the man himself didn't survive the night. Looking back on it now, however, the very homeliness of the expression and its rough delivery was a morale booster for us at a time when we could certainly do with one. Such men are worth their weight in gold at times of stress. Oh dear. I don't know whether to laugh or cry at some of these stories. I really don't. You'll have to excuse me. Sometimes I'm reading this for the first time, or if I've read it before, I've forgotten it, and I suddenly come across a funny bit, and I can see what's coming. And you might think, why is he laughing? And eventually you find out. But anyway, next story. This one's called Tea Break. We were holding the forward defence line on a track up the coast from Balikpapan in Borneo. As was usual, we had standing patrols in no man's land to warn of any approaching enemy parties. sections took turns in manning our post, which was about 400 metres forward of the main position. Things had been relatively quiet for a few days and we were taking life a little bit easily, protected by our outposts. We'd boiled the billy back in the company lines one day, and feeling some sympathy for the section manning the post, I said, "I'll take a drink up to Lynchy's mob." The post was in an exposed position where it would not have been safe to light a fire. Carrying the billy of tea in my right hand and with an enamel mug hanging from each finger on my left hand, which also held upright an opened can of unsweetened condensed milk, I set off up the track. For some inexplicable reason, I did not carry a weapon or even my steel helmet. This was the first and only time during the whole war that I can remember being unarmed in a forward area. Looking back now, I can't imagine what possessed me to do such a foolish thing. I was a Bren gunner at the time, and it would not have been possible for me to carry the Bren, but I could and should have borrowed a rifle or an Owen gun. Strangely enough, nobody else seemed to notice my carelessness either. I was about 20 metres from the standing patrol when there was a burst of automatic fire from our people, followed by a general exchange of fire. I moved off the track and stood behind a large tree, listening to the firing and trying to make up my mind whether it was the result of minor enemy patrol activity or whether it was the forerunner of an enemy attack. If it was the latter, I was in real trouble. I've never felt so exposed or so useless in my life. The firing died down after a few minutes. The ridiculousness of my situation was such that it would have been an embarrassment for me to go back. So I went forward until I could see our people, some of whom were still firing, and I called in a stage whisper, "Hey, Lynchy, do you feel like a cup of tea?" His instant reply, "My oath, I'm as dry as a chip," somehow made it all worthwhile. I've often thought that if that situation was portrayed in the film, no one would believe that it was realistic. Oh dear, I hope my Australian accent passes muster, but if not, then I hope it's at least giving you a good giggle. We're seeing quite a lot of action in this episode, aren't we? Good way to go out. Here's the next story, and it's called Making a Clean Escape. When the war ended, we spent a few days cutting posts for the prisoner of war compounds being built in Borneo. Then we sailed to Makassar in the Celebus to oversee the surrender there. Makassar was in a turmoil of political unrest when we arrived. All day long, and often into the night, there were massed crowds of excited men being harangued by speakers. There was some violence, particularly at night, and much of the animosity appeared to be directed against the people from Ambon Island who were living there. From what we were led to believe, the antagonism was caused at least in part by the fact that the Ambonese had remained loyal to the Dutch during the war, whereas the Indonesians had sided with the Japanese. It was the commencement of the anti-colonial movement in Indonesia, and I suppose that anybody who was friendly with the Dutch would have been unpopular with the Indonesians. As Makassar was primarily an Indonesian town, of course the majority of people were Indonesian. The political activists wore a red and white ribbon, the colours which subsequently became the colours of the Indonesian flag. We were specifically instructed not to become involved in the political struggle, but at the same time we were told that if we saw some dastardly act being committed, we were expected to act as men and to protect the weak. To protect themselves, the Ambonese had formed a volunteer army that was stationed in barracks surrounded by a high stone wall opposite where we were. If a man enlisted in this army, he could bring his family to live safely within the wall. In retrospect, it's certain that the Dutch administration, reinstated by our presence, organised this army and provided the weapons and equipment. While it was reasonably safe in daylight, gangs roamed the streets after dark, and there was shouting and screaming, burning of houses, and the occasional sound of firing. It would sometimes be dark by the time a man had gone through the formalities of enlisting and had been issued with his gear. He'd be anxious not to leave his family by themselves in their house for the night, but was afraid to go back alone and get them. The new recruit would ask us to accompany him to his home to bring his family back to the barracks. We interpreted this as being within the spirit of the acting as men rule. It was unofficial, but we went. We went in pairs, usually one with a rifle and bayonet, the other with an Owen gun, and each carrying a couple of grenades. We were never threatened or molested, despite passing through large groups of demonstrators, or whatever the crowds were. One night, however, we came face to face with a group that had obviously been looting a house. One of them had a full-sized grandfather clock balanced on a bicycle. This group showed some signs of belligerence, on which the Ambonese soldier raised his rifle and fired. I knocked the barrel up as he fired, causing the bullet to miss, and made it clear to him not to do it again. The shot alarmed the group, which scattered and ran, dropping most of the loot. I can still remember the hideous clatter the grandfather clock made when it hit the ground. One of them carried a bundle of square yellow sticks, which from their colour and shape I took to be a high explosive, used both by us and by the Japanese. He still carried them when he ran, which gave me the impression that they were something special to him. Explosives in the hands of these people were of much greater concern to us than a few stolen household goods, so it was in all our interests that he didn't get away. I ran after him, grabbing his shirt, and with my left hand and with my rifle, with bayonet fixed, held at the point of balance as one would hold a knife, I spun him round with a point close to his face. He dropped the yellow sticks. I relieved him of the rusty sword he was carrying in his waistband and indicated to him that he should depart. This he did with alacrity. On closer examination, we found that the yellow sticks were pieces of homemade soap. Oh. Smoking is a health hazard. Just for starters, there's a word used in this story. It's Stygian, and the definition of Stygian is extremely and unpleasantly dark, and it comes from the river Styx of the underworld in Greek mythology. Anyone who's been in the tropical jungle at night will be aware of the disorientating effect of the Stygian darkness. Also, that it's virtually impossible to move silently at night except along tracks. Because of this, while guards were posted generally around the perimeter, special attention was paid to the tracks, where at least one Bren light machine gun would be posted. My mate Dick Hill and I were in a weapon pit about 8 metres from the track where the gun was posted. Dick was a heavy smoker. One night when we'd been awoken for our shift, Dick said, "I've got to have a smoke. You go and let the others get their heads down, and I'll come along after I've had a drag." Smoking in the front line at night meant pulling a ground sheet over the pit to prevent the glow of the cigarette from being seen. Not that this was very effective. The noisy scratching of a wax match on its tin box was loud enough to wake the dead, and even through the ground sheet, all the nearby trees stood out in relief when the match flared, and to a lesser extent each time the smoker drew on the cigarette. I relieved those on duty, who went back to their own position, leaving me alone. The time went by without Dick turning up, and after about 15 minutes I assumed that he'd gone back to sleep. Mentally fuming at this apparent lack of consideration, I couldn't leave the post to go back and wake him. Angry at events and my impotency, I suddenly became aware that something was moving in the jungle alongside the track about 10 metres in front of me. It was a stealthy sound of someone or something trying to move quietly, and it sounded more human than animal. I switched the chain lever on the Bren from safety to automatic and ensured that my grenades were at hand. The sound of movement approached, then turned across my front and approached again through the jungle. I was just thinking that it was about time for me to do something about it, when I heard a hoarse stage whisper call, "Cookie, where the bloody hell are you?" It was Dick, who'd become completely disoriented when he left our weapon pit and had taken more than 15 minutes to get to a place which was only a few metres from where he'd started. To make matters even worse, he'd strayed into no man's land when the danger from both sides at night is very great. The Beast and Beauty. It was early August 1945 and the war was nearly over, but we didn't know it at the time. We knew that the Americans were at Iwo Jima, at the very gates of Japan, but the Japanese still had large numbers of fighting men at home and in the islands, and their fanaticism was well known. Who at that time could have predicted the traumatic effect on them of the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki? Of course, we didn't even know that the bombs existed. The sudden end came as a complete surprise, but as a welcome relief to us, particularly those who'd been in it since the early days. The war had dragged on for almost 6 years, and we were getting tired. It would not be an understatement to say that it had had a profound effect on our young lives. In the area where I was, it was apparent a few days before the end that something unusual had happened. Even our long-range patrols had failed to make contact with the enemy, although there was plenty of evidence that they were still here. It was out of character for them, but they seemed to be avoiding us. The thought had not occurred to me before, but it's possible also that our high command knew that the end was imminent and did its best to keep us apart. We merely did what we were told. As an indication of the relatively peaceful life we were leading, we'd shot a wild pig on the bank of a river one day at the start of one of our regular daily patrols. It wasn't a normal practice for patrols to advertise their presence in no man's land by such indiscriminate shooting, so we must have felt more than usually secure. We cut its throat to bleed it, and hung it on the branch of a tree to keep it away from other animals and crocodiles, intending to pick it up on our way back at the end of the day. The whole animal was too heavy for us to carry, so using a machete, we cut off its back legs where they joined its body, tied them onto a stick, and carried them back to our lines. As we went past the regimental aid post, the doctor came out and asked us where we were taking the meat. On being told that we were going to eat it, he produced a shovel and told us to dig a hole and bury it, and he watched while we did it. He reminded us that the pigs had all sorts of diseases, so were unsafe to eat. We'd been told this many times, but obviously hadn't taken the warning seriously. A few days later, I was forward scout on a patrol. This is a position where one moves very warily, being careful not to make any sound or rapid movement, and at the same time keeps a watchful eye on the area in front. Even leaves turned back to front is an alarm signal. The scout, and indeed the whole patrol, moves close to the edge of the track to reduce its visibility, and to enable it to fade into the jungle instantly if necessary. In this place, the track itself was less than a metre wide, although the jungle alongside was not dense. It had been raining heavily for some time, but the rain had just stopped. As I came around a bend in the track, there was a small deer standing facing me and only about 3 metres away. It was a spotted brown deer with huge brown eyes, just like Bambi in the Walt Disney cartoons. Although unaware of my presence, I could see from its stance that it sensed danger, but was not able to distinguish where the threat lay. The first instinct of anyone on point duty when something unusual is sighted is to shoot, or at least be ready to. This conditioned reflex occurs faster than the mind can interpret what the eyes have seen and translate it into intelligent action. Both the deer and I were frozen in time for a fraction of a second while my brain caught up. It was looking directly at me, but not seeing me. I was looking along the sights of my rifle with my finger having already taken up first pressure on the trigger. Once again, visions of fresh meat went through all our minds. I couldn't have missed from that distance. Perhaps it was our recent futile experience with the pig, or perhaps it was the beauty and utter helplessness of the deer, but whatever the reason, I couldn't do it, and lowered my rifle. Seeing me do this, the man behind me stepped to one side to shoot past me, but I put my hand on his rifle, saying, "Let it go." The movement frightened the deer, which instantly bounded away into the jungle. I was unable to explain my actions to the others except to say, "I don't know why I did it. I'm just tired of it all." Although I grew up with a rifle in my hands and was a keen hunter before the war, I've not hunted since. I've occasionally taken our grandchildren fishing at their request, but I did this entirely for educational purposes. I'd do the same if they wanted to shoot game, and for the same reason, but I would not derive any pleasure from it. Perhaps it isn't something one should say with great pride, but the last animal I tried to kill was a man. Repatriating the Koreans. One of the earliest tasks for the occupation forces in Japan after the war was the repatriation of thousands of Koreans who had been brought to Japan as a workforce. Korea had been occupied by the Japanese for many years prior to the war, so it's more than possible that the Koreans in Japan were not there of their own choosing. They were not just single men and women, but comprised entire families. I've no idea how long these people had been in Japan, but it was apparent from the ages of the children that some of them had been born there. For reasons unknown to me, the Koreans seemed mostly to have been living and working in the north of the main Japanese island of Honshu and in Hokkaido. For some weeks, trainloads of these people were being transported daily down the length of the Japanese islands to the South Island, Kyushu, from where they were shipped back to Korea. My battalion was stationed at Fukuyama on the inland sea of Japan at the time. The Americans escorted the trains from wherever they originated to Fukuyama. We took them over there and escorted them to Fukuoka on Kyushu, where the New Zealanders organised their shipment to Korea. Each train comprised 7 or 8 carriages, of which one was set aside for the escort. The escort was of platoon strength, numbering about 30, so we had plenty of room. The Koreans, on the other hand, were crammed in so tightly that it must have been very difficult for them. They had all their household possessions with them, including chickens in cages and other animals. They must also have carried their own food, because as far as I can recall, no provision was made for feeding them while they were under our control. I can't remember if there was some special reason for the timing, but we seemed always to take over the trains late in the evening, travel through the night, hand the Koreans over to the New Zealanders the next day, and leave on the return trip in the evening of the same day. Although we travelled in relative comfort on the trains, it was a tiring round trip of 36 hours without much sleep. The Koreans were not allowed to leave the train while in transit. Each time it stopped, we formed a ring around the train to ensure that none did. We weren't told the reason for this, and I still don't know whether we were there to stop them from escaping so they could remain in Japan, or that it was to prevent them and the Japanese from attacking each other. There was a concrete tunnel about 8 kilometres long under the sea from Shimonoseki on the main island to the South Island Kyushu. The steam engines on the train were replaced with electric engines for the 20-minute journey through this tunnel. I don't know whether this was done to keep the tunnel free of smoke or for some other reason. Only one train could be in the tunnel at any one time because there was only one line. Although it had obviously been there for many years, the condition of the tunnel did not inspire confidence. There were many large cracks in the ceiling and walls through which the seawater ran in rivulets, and the pumps must have been working continuously to stop that tunnel filling with water. It's interesting to see how one's memory selects certain places or events to be retained. The names of the railway stations in the villages through which the line passed were written both in Japanese and English. The signs appeared to be old, so I can only assume that they'd been there before the war. Japan was the only country I can recall where the name of the station was shown in the centre of the sign in large letters, with the names of the stations either side in smaller letters each side. It was an excellent idea, and one that other countries would do well to follow. For some reason, I can still remember the name of one of the small villages through which we passed in the dark both ways. Perhaps I remember it because of its musical ring. Hashio Nematsu. Souvenirs? What a joke. Every group of Australians I've ever been with has had at least one practical joker. The master of them all in our company was a Queenslander who was utterly spontaneous and irrepressible. When the engineers visited us to explain and demonstrate the use of explosives, he always managed to relieve them of some Murray switches, instantaneous fuse and explosive material. Woe betide the innocent who let down his guard while these things were about. Another of his tricks was to catch a rock python snake about 2 metres long and bandage its head with a field dressing. These snakes aren't poisonous, but their bite can draw blood. He would empty someone's pack of its contents and fold the snake into the pack and do up the straps. The effect on the owner when he went to get something from his pack, often in the dark, was quite dramatic. We were held up at the Mangar River in Borneo waiting for the tanks to come forward to support an attack on an airstrip across the river. There was a concrete bridge over the river, but the whole area was under direct enemy observation from the high ground behind the airstrip, and any movement attracted artillery fire. One practical joker had taken the section's water bottles down to a creek to fill them. He was crossing the road on his way back when a US Navy jeep containing several sailors from the landing ships stopped, and one of the sailors asked him for directions to the front line. Their ship was leaving that day, and they wanted to get some souvenirs to take home. They couldn't have picked a worse man on the whole island. Without thinking, I'm sure, he told them to go up the road a short distance where they'd see a bridge. They should cross the bridge, then turn left immediately onto the airstrip where they'd find the front line. Thanking him, they drove on. We were dug in close to the road and asked him as he passed us what the sailors were doing there. Scarcely had he begun to explain when a salvo of shots signalled the almost simultaneous arrival on the bridge of the jeep and the first of the enemy shells. Unable to turn the jeep on the bridge, the driver hastily selected reverse gear and the vehicle came roaring backwards down the road with some very alarmed-looking sailors who had much more important things on their minds than souvenirs. As nobody had been hurt, our practical joker was quite unrepentant about what he'd done. In fairness to him, perhaps he thought that what he'd said to them was so obviously ridiculous that they would have realised it was a joke, but they'd driven on before he could disillusion them. It would certainly have been apparent to any experienced soldier that we were the front line. I honestly believe, however, that he couldn't help himself. Perhaps it's a sign of the true practical joker that he does not even consider beforehand the possible consequences of his jokes. The dentist. Like most people of my generation, I have an unreasoning fear of dentists. We were training in North Queensland in 1945. My battalion did not have its own dentist, but there was one with our sister battalion camped about 1 kilometre away. Anyone from my battalion requiring dental attention had to attend sick parade to see our doctor, who'd issue a referral to the dentist. We were packed, ready to go away again, and about to leave camp. All surplus kit and clothing had been sent to storage. We didn't know where we were going, but it seemed highly probable from our recent training that we would be making a beach landing. My section leader and I were both in need of dental attention, so had reported sick and were duly referred to the dentist. We walked across through the bush in silence, heads down, hands in pockets, and deep in thought. We'd both been in the Middle East, and had already served through 2 campaigns in New Guinea. I remember breaking the silence by asking, "Are you thinking of what I'm thinking, Gibby?" He replied, "I think I might be. What are you thinking?" I said, "I'm thinking that it would be silly for us to go through the suffering of having our teeth drilled by the dentist with his pedal drill now, when in a few days we might be dead. Let's wait until we see how the landing goes. If we're still alive after that, then we'll go to the dentist." We didn't see the dentist that day. We sat under a tree for an hour or so, then reported back to the battalion feeling very clever with ourselves that we'd avoided, or at least postponed, one of life's unpleasantries. There's an epilogue and a moral to this story. It was a long time before I had another opportunity to get to a dentist, and the damage to the tooth was so advanced by then that the tooth was extracted. That momentary lapse in moral fortitude was almost certainly responsible for the loss of the only tooth missing from my lower jaw. War's End. We were in Borneo when the war against Japan ended on 15th of August, 1945. The Japanese capitulated on that day, less than 2 weeks after the dropping of the first atomic bomb on Hiroshima and the second on Nagasaki a few days later. I can't remember whether or not we'd been told of the bombs, or even if there were any rumours, but it was apparent to us a few days before the end that something unusual was happening. Our patrols into no man's land had failed to make any contact with the enemy. My company had just been withdrawn for a rest and was camped on the beach near the mouth of the Mangar River. This was some distance from the front line, and, as was usual in such circumstances, all weapons were unloaded. Those with automatic weapons had emptied their magazines to clean them and had left them empty to relieve the tension on the magazine springs. It was after we'd gone to sleep, but before midnight, when there was a sudden outburst of gunfire all around us. It was impossible to tell what was happening, but whatever it was widespread. Those of us who'd been at Gona when the Japanese tried to break out on the last night immediately assumed it was a recurrence of that suicidal behaviour. Magazines were hastily reloaded in the dark and preparations were made for the expected onslaught. It's interesting to see how deeply one's reactions to an unusual happening are governed by past experience. On this occasion, the reaction of those who'd been at Gona was quite different to the others. We were all equally confused, but the others who had not been through that chaotic experience didn't see the same urgent need to be ready for an emergency. The firing eventually died down and we went back to bed, but we slept lightly if we slept at all. The next morning we were told officially that the Japanese had surrendered. to prevent unnecessary casualties, we were told to avoid contact with the enemy if possible until formal arrangements had been made. If we did make contact and they wished to surrender, we were to take them prisoner. If they wished to continue fighting, we were to retaliate accordingly. The whole affair of the surrender went smoothly as far as we were concerned, and largely without incident. Unfortunately, however, some events did occur after the 15th of August, causing deaths on both sides. It was generally believed that our last casualty in our immediate area was a man who had what would be considered to be a reasonably safe job. He was a member of a mosquito control unit whose task it was to spray oil on stagnant pools of water to prevent the mosquitoes from breeding. The man wasn't armed when he walked into a hut to find a Japanese soldier, either very sick or wounded, sitting on the floor with a rifle across his knees. Instead of falling backwards out of the door and running for his life as any experienced soldier would have done, this man tried to explain to the Japanese that the war was over and that he should surrender. At the same time, he tried to take the rifle away from him. As his efforts were proving unsuccessful, the man called to his sergeant, who was close by, asking for help. The sergeant had a pistol. He ran into the hut and shot the Japanese, who fell back, pulling the trigger as he did, and killing the man with whom he was struggling. Wine, women, but no song. Arriving in Japan during their winter, we spent a few weeks at the Kataishi barracks near Kure. Then our company went to Onimichi on the inland sea, where we were stationed in a schoolhouse some distance out of the town. The town itself must have been declared out of bounds, because I have no recollection of ever visiting it. When I look back on my time in Japan, except for the 2 months I was in Tokyo, I was never stationed in a place that was close to the civilian population. Fraternization with the Japanese was discouraged, and in any case, many of us still retained the bitterness that had developed during the war and had no desire to associate with them. I suppose that from their point of view, most of them would have had no desire to be friendly towards us, although in the whole year that I was there, I didn't see any outward sign of hostility. We were engaged at Onimichi in patrolling the immediate area and the nearby islands in the inland sea. These patrols were done on foot, except that we did have the use of a Japanese fishing boat to get out to the island. I'm not sure of the reasons for the patrols, other than to show the flag. It wasn't a stressful job, and indeed became quite boring. I was starting to realise that I was not cut out to be a peacetime soldier. As with any group of men, there are always a certain few who will go to the utmost trouble to find alcoholic drink and girls. I'm not sure which of these provides the more compelling drive, but they certainly go together. By the looks of the girls I've seen in the places where these two commodities are readily available in many countries of the world, I've come to the conclusion that the alcohol must come first. Whoever coined the expressions, as ugly as a robber's dog, and so ugly she'd turn a funeral down a side. So ugly she'd turn a funeral down a side street, probably sat in the same places and looked on the same scenes through sober eyes as I did. Only a befuddled brain would have allowed any association at all to develop with most of the girls. The nearest place where drink and girls were available, and which was not policed by the military police, was a village about 2 miles away. This was frequented by those so inclined, and became known as the 2 Mile, from the poem Lost by Banjo Paterson. It had become a common practice for those going to the village to leave after dark and to return to camp before the morning roll call, but sometimes they'd be late in getting back. When their names were called twice without response, some wag in the ranks would recite, in a quiet voice, the words from the poem, "He ought to be home," said the old man. "Without, there's something amiss. He only went to the 2 mile. He ought to be back by this." Sometimes, as we marched through this village on patrol to the hinterland, the girls would be outside and would call one or more of our people by name. Instead of responding, the person concerned would become embarrassed, try to look inconspicuous, and would make such comments as, "I've never seen her before. There must be lots of blokes called Curly, or Skeeter, or Pud, or whatever nickname the girl had used. The cold, sober light of day is very unforgiving, and it's fair to say that those concerned usually had every reason to feel embarrassed." In an endeavour to put a stop to this illegal behaviour, a check of all beds was made by the orderly officer at Lights Out each evening to ensure that all were in camp. This was not even initially successful, as those who intended to leave camp merely went to bed fully dressed and left as soon as the inspection was over. When it became apparent that the inspection wasn't having the desired effect, the orderly officer started to patrol the roadway outside the camp each morning before reveille, with a view to catching those sneaking back to camp. This was marginally successful for a short time. Some offenders were punished and might even have been deterred from repeating the offence. The wiser or more determined among them took up football training, and when caught coming back into camp before reveille, would say that they'd got up early to go for a run. Their determination and ingeniousness knew no bounds. Needless to say, in the circumstances, the incidence of various forms of sexually transmitted disease was high. Penicillin had been invented, and it was generally believed that it was a magic cure for all forms of venereal disease, so the fear of contracting the complaint had greatly diminished since the early days. In most people's minds, VD was now no more dangerous than a common cold. In the event, penicillin was not quite the magic cure it was thought to be, as some forms of the disease were apparently resistant to it. The large numbers of those infected became a matter of great concern to the army in the field, and apparently also to the politicians in Australia. Statistically, I think that about 1 in 3 of the occupation force was affected, although this ratio is not a true reflection of the actual numbers, because many of them were repeat offenders. It was the only place in my almost 7 years with the AIF that the numbers of those suffering from VD in each of the battalions was read out in routine orders on battalion parades, invariably followed by a lecture from the CO, particularly if our battalion had the highest figure. We even had a group of our politicians visit Japan to investigate the cause and to make recommendations on the best way of stopping it. Their visit might have been enlightening for them, but was about as effective as King Canute ordering the incoming tide to go back. All of us in Japan knew the cause. The question was how to stop it. At one stage following the politicians' visit, the NCOs were paraded together and told that from then on we would be held personally responsible and reduced to the ranks if anybody in our platoons contracted the disease. I ripped the stripes off my shirt and threw them onto the floor, saying, "Well, you may as well take my stripes now. There's nothing I can do to prevent what's happening. How can I be held responsible for 30 men going 30 different directions at once when they're on leave?" This ridiculous order must have originated with the politicians. No military officer would have been foolish enough to even think of it. Perhaps it started with the commander of the Australian contingent being told that he would be held responsible, and he just passed it down the line, as the top brass does. It was clear to us from the start that our own officers were operating under outside instructions in giving the order. They would have been able to see as well as we could that it was unreasonable and would not achieve anything except deprive the battalion of its NCOs. They'd given their orders as directed, but left us with the clear impression that no action would be taken against us if it proved unsuccessful. A wink being as good as a nod to a blind horse, we did nothing, and in due course the whole thing was forgotten. The rate of infection continued unabated. On guard in Tokyo. Looking through some old wartime papers recently, I came across a movement order dated 12th of May 1946, instructing me to take charge of 9 others and report to the AIF battalion at Tokyo. My company was stationed at a Japanese naval training station at Fukuyama on the inland sea of Japan at the time. It's typical of people's resistance to change that we were still officially calling ourselves Australian Imperial Force, AIF, when our correct designation was British Commonwealth Occupation Forces, BCOF. The Australians were the first members of the BCOF to take over guard duties at the Emperor's Palace in Tokyo from the Americans. National pride made it important that we put on a good show on what at that time was a world stage. With due modesty, I believe that we achieved that goal. Indeed, contrary to what's often said of the Australian soldier, he is as good at ceremonial duties as any soldier in the world. A composite force of about 150 all ranks, comprising 10 men from each company of the 3 Australian battalions, had been selected for the task. We were all over 5'10", 1.75 metres, in height, and most, if not all, were experienced soldiers, having come directly to Japan from the 3 AIF divisions serving in the Pacific when the war ended. With our height and our long rifles and bayonets, we dwarfed the Americans with their carbines. Also, contrary to what's often said about Australian discipline on parade, our ceremonial drill in such situations was exemplary. With due modesty, we looked and acted the part. There were times when it seemed that the newsreel photographers around us and almost under our feet outnumbered the guards. Our wartime experience had not prepared us for this exposure to publicity, which initially put a lot of strain on everybody, but particularly on the guard commanders. Being in front of our guards throughout the ceremony, we felt very exposed and very conscious of the need not to make a mistake. I suppose that an actor going onto the public stage for the first time would have felt as we did. Indeed, there were some among us who, having been through it once, would not do it again. Conversion from the AIF to the BCOF had turned us into a peacetime army. All our webbing equipment had to be blancored white, and all brass buckles and fittings on the equipment polished daily. The blacking was removed from our hat, collar and shoulder badges and tunic buttons, all of which were made of copper, and these also had to be polished daily. I can't remember how or when all this started, but it got to the ridiculous end that we even cleaned the bluing from our bayonets and kept the steel polished. We wore green drill shirts and slacks in the hot weather, and these were kept looking neat by folding them while still partly wet and sleeping on them to set the creases. Blankoing the webbing particularly was the source of many fits of great anger. It was necessary to remove all brass buckles and fittings from the belt and straps before applying the blanco, which was then allowed to dry while the brass fittings were polished. The equipment was then assembled very carefully to prevent the brass fittings making a mark on the white belt and straps. Once assembled, it was impossible to move any of the brass fittings without making a mark, so great care was exercised to ensure that everything was in its right place the first time. Any mark on the webbing meant that the whole process had to be repeated. Hardly a day went by without somebody doing something wrong, the most common error being forgetting to put the bayonet scabbard frog onto the belt before assembling the rest of the fittings. This error would usually be observed by those around the unfortunate victim, but nobody would say anything until it was too late, when someone would ask innocently, "Aren't you going to take your bayonet?" None of us escaped. Guard commanders wore a coloured silk sash about 10 centimetres wide over the right shoulder across the chest, with a tassel hanging underneath the bayonet scabbard, or in the case of the officers, under the revolver pouch. Commissioned officers wore a blue sash and the NCOs a red one. While in Tokyo for this tour of duty, we were based in a four-storied office building only a short distance from the Emperor's Palace. The building had belonged to Britain and probably was the home of the British Embassy in Tokyo before the war. Indeed, it still had the Union Jack flying over it when I visited Japan again in 1976. When not on guard duty, we ate at the nearby Imperial Hotel, which was occupied by the Americans. As was usual with the Americans, the food was much better than that to which we'd been accustomed. The guard on the Emperor's Palace alone comprised almost half our entire force. Smaller guards were mounted at BCOF headquarters, the Meiji and Yasukuni shrines, and somewhere else, but I can't remember the other place. We were not told the reasons why we were guarding the palace or the shrines, but I suppose it was because if there was to be an uprising against us, it would most likely start at one of these places of deep religious significance. On the other hand, of course, we might have been there solely to prevent the desecration of these holy places by unbelievers. It wasn't until many years after the war that I discovered that in the Shinto belief, the spirits of members of the Japanese armed forces who'd been killed in battle congregated at the Yasukuni Shrine. The Japanese custodians of this shrine were old soldiers. I can see them now standing in front of the entrance gate at dawn and dusk each day, bowing deeply towards the shrine building and clapping their hands to attract the attention of the spirits to the fact that they were about to open or close the gates. It was interesting to see the marked difference in religious observance towards the emperor between the old and the young, even in those days. A major road led to each of the palace gates like the spokes of a wheel, with the palace at its hub. Older people on their way to and from wherever they were going daily, and crossing one of these roads at a point where they could see the palace, would turn towards the palace, remove their hats and bow deeply before proceeding on their way. The younger ones would do the same if accompanied by an older person, but rarely if alone. The palace grounds were surrounded by a moat and a high stone wall several kilometres long with 15 or 16 gates. A guard was posted at each gate. Because of the distance involved, it wasn't possible to march the relief parties around the posts as is normally done when changing the guard. The relief party was transported by truck to a place close to each guard post, at which point it debussed, marched to the actual guard post, and the formal change was made in the normal fashion. Then the party marched back to the truck and went on to the next post. We were on guard almost continuously for the whole month we were in Tokyo. With the exception of those individuals actually on guard at the smaller posts, the remainder were withdrawn each afternoon, prepared themselves for the occasion, and marched from BCOF headquarters to the plaza in front of the Emperor's Palace to take their part in the guard-changing ceremony. In this manner, the men were rotated from the more demanding nature of the palace guard to the quieter, smaller guards, but there was very little free time for anybody. The Army Guard Relief System provided for 2 hours on and 4 hours off, and at least one of the off-duty periods each day was spent preparing for the next ceremonial changing of the guard. We didn't have much time for sightseeing, not that there was much to see anyway, because Tokyo had been almost as completely destroyed as Hiroshima. When I look back on it now, we can't have had much time for sleeping either. With very few exceptions, the longest break off duty for any of us during that month would have been 4 hours. We were glad to get back to the battalion for a rest. One of the worst positions for a guard post I ever saw during my military service was one at the top of the steps leading up to the entrance to BCOF headquarters, particularly in the hot weather when the afternoon sun shone full in the face of the sentry. The curved steps were quite narrow. The sentry stood on the top step, where he could not march a beat, but must remain stationary while on duty there. I changed the sentry at this post every half hour in the hot weather, instead of the normal 2 hours. General Robertson, Red Robbie, was appointed to command the Australian component of the BCOF in mid-1946. He had a reputation for being a stickler for protocol. Because of his rank, sentries were required to salute the general by presenting arms whenever he appeared. This was no problem, of course, when the general was entering the building, but when leaving, he was not visible to the sentry, who was facing his front. This was no problem, of course, when the general was entering the building, but when leaving the building, he wasn't visible to the sentry who was facing his front until he'd passed by him and was actually descending the steps. This caused a great flurry of movement on the part of the sentry, and also required the general to turn back towards the sentry and return the salute as he walked down the steps. A somewhat dangerous thing to do. To overcome this problem, the general had a full-length mirror installed above and in front of the guard post to enable the sentry to observe his approach from the rear. Thereafter, the sentry presented arms to the reflection of the general in the mirror, and the general was able to return the salute before he reached the steps. Oh dear. A civilian concert party from Australia visited Tokyo while we were there. The party comprised both men and girls, the girls being accommodated on the top floor of the BCOF headquarters building. The top floor was placed out of bounds to all men during their stay, a sentry being posted at the top of the stairs to ensure that this rule was obeyed. The building did not have a lift. Late one evening, I was visiting the sentry at this guard post when a group of the girls, accompanied by some of our officers carrying armfuls of bottles of drink, etc., arrived at the top of the stairs, obviously intent on having a party in the girls' rooms. The sentry immediately informed the officers that by order of the commanding officer, the area was out of bounds to all ranks. The officers accepted the situation, albeit grudgingly, and were in the process of leaving when some of the girls started railing against the rule. They said they'd given up their time and had come a long way out of the kindness of their hearts to entertain the troops. Not being members of the armed forces, they would not accept this unwarranted restriction on their freedom. They demanded to see the sentry's senior officer. I'd been standing in the background until this occurred, but then stepped forward, saying that I was the guard commander and reiterating the sentry's instructions. On being asked by one of the girls the name of the originator of the order, I said that I took my orders from the commanding officer, AIF Battalion, Tokyo. On being told his name and that he lived in the building, she announced that she'd go and see him immediately and have the ridiculous order rescinded. I agreed that she was at liberty to do so, but pointed out that he did not give orders lightly and might not welcome being awoken at this late hour over the matter. I said that in the meantime I would follow his instructions to the letter. It would be fair to say that we didn't part company on very good terms, but a couple of the girls did come out later and apologise for her behaviour. The officers had long since gone back down the stairs with their bottles of drink and other supplies. The entire battalion went to Tokyo for a tour of duty a few months later, but with more people available, it was a much less arduous task for us. On this second occasion, we camped at what had been a Japanese military establishment at Ebisu, a suburb of Tokyo. This had become the residence for all the BCOF troops while on duty in Tokyo. A British regiment took over from us when we left. It's never the same going back to a place for the second time, particularly if the conditions have markedly changed. My recollections of that second visit to Tokyo are much less vivid than those of the first. When I look back on our tour of duty in Japan, I find it somewhat surprising that at no time were our rifles loaded, nor did we even carry live ammunition. I assume that our armoury held stocks of ammunition, and also our machine guns, submachine guns, mortars, etc., but we didn't see them either all the time we were there. We were occupying the country of a former enemy whose fanaticism was well known, but apparently we didn't see anything strange at the time in being virtually unarmed, because I can't remember it even being discussed. As guard commander, however, I was conscious of the potential risk and always made a point of visiting the isolated posts frequently during the hours of darkness. Shaking all over. Just before we came home from Japan in January 1947, we were stationed at a Japanese naval base on the island of Maiwa Jima in Kuo Bay. It had been a permanent base, the buildings being two-storied and constructed of reinforced concrete. My company occupied the second floor of one of these buildings. It was winter in Japan, and the nights were cold, even that far south. We were woken at about 4 o'clock one morning by the loud roar and the violent vibrations of an earthquake. Its epicentre was some distance away in the inland sea, where the resultant tidal wave caused considerable damage on an island, but it was close enough to alarm us who were not accustomed to these phenomena. I think that it was the sound that woke me. The shocks seemed to come a few seconds later. The building started to sway. Tall cupboards fell over. Light fittings crashed to the floor, and there was general pandemonium. The overhead power wires outside the building were touching as they swung, lighting up the area with flashes of blue light until the power failed altogether. There'd been a few seconds' delay before I realised what was happening, but when I did, I can remember saying to my people, "This is it. Get your coats and boots on and get out of the building. Move steadily, don't run." I can't remember if I added the famous words, don't panic, but I might well have done so. The rooms in the building had sliding doors. Either the movement of the building had caused our door to stick, or we damaged it in our attempts to get out in the darkness. Whatever the cause, it wouldn't slide, and we had to break it off its tracks. The earthquake continued for some time after we found our way down the stairs and out of the building. It might have been my imagination, but looking up at the building, it actually appeared to be moving. The major shocks were followed by a series of tremors. It was freezing outside, but we were reluctant to go back into the building while these tremors persisted. One of our officers kept telling us to return to the building, saying in a soothing voice, "It's all over now. You can go back to bed." I still wonder what special gift he thought he had, other than holding the King's Commission, that would have enabled him to know this. We certainly didn't share his confidence. We did go back to bed eventually, but I doubt if anyone went to sleep. There was still an occasional tremor, and we all wanted to be ready to leave instantly if it started again. As it happened, there was no structural damage done to the buildings, and nobody had been seriously hurt. Indeed, in the cold night of day, the whole thing appeared to have been a bit of a non-event. I met a man on the ship coming home who'd had a much more alarming experience during the earthquake. He was in the Kaitashi barracks on the mainland. The buildings there were single-storey, with the floors about 1 metre above the ground. When he realised what was happening, he opened the window, jumped to the ground, and without any conscious thought for what he was doing, he started to run away from the building. The barracks were on low-lying land close to the sea. Indeed, much of the area had been recovered from the sea by building it up. Open concrete drains about 4 metres wide and 3 metres deep had been constructed at frequent intervals to accommodate the rise and fall of the tides. The sides of the drains were almost vertical, and they were not fenced. They were dry when the tide was out. Running blindly from the building, the man was just winding up to speed when the ground disappeared from under his feet, and he fell into one of the open drains. He was lucky that he didn't break any bones, but the drop had stunned and disoriented him. From what he'd read on the subject, he believed he'd fallen into a fissure caused by the earthquake, and he had no idea how deep it might be. His reason told him, however, that the same forces that had caused the fissure to open could also cause it to close, with him at the bottom. Naturally, this was a matter of some concern to him. The night was dark, but the sky was partially clear. He remembered that as a child he'd been told that if one was down a deep mineshaft, one could see the stars even in daylight. Looking up at the sky, the stars appeared to be brighter than he had ever seen them before, and he was convinced that he was a long way below the surface. He made many valiant attempts to climb out, but the sides were too deep and too smooth for him to get a grip, and he succeeded only in breaking his fingernails. He'd walked a short distance each way along the drain, hoping to find a place where he could get a grip on the walls, but without success. Becoming exhausted with his efforts and accepting the inevitable, he sat down feeling very cold and miserable to await the dawn. When the darkness faded, it was with great relief that he saw the top of the drain only about half a metre above the reach of his fingers. Smithy. We had a most unusual man in my platoon in the occupation force in Japan after the war. I'll call him Smith, but that was not his name. Unlike many of us who'd come straight from the three AIF divisions serving in the islands when the war ended, he'd come straight to Japan from Australia. Smithy was never meant to be a soldier. He was untidy, unreliable, and was always in trouble, committing mostly only minor breaches of discipline, which resulted in fines and being confined to barracks for short periods, with the normal punishments that entails. Not to put too fine a point on it, we would have been better off without him. Not long before we were due to come home, he became convinced that the Soviet Union form of government was the ideal for the working man. He went AWL and set out on his own to make his way to Russia, intending somehow to get to Vladivostok via the northern Japanese island of Hokkaido. As the Australians were only on the main island of Honshu, his Australian uniform was obviously out of place on Hokkaido, where he was arrested by the US military police and returned to us. I went to see him in the compound when he got back, and said to him, "You've really done it now, Smithy. What story are you going to tell to the CO? The communist ideology won't wash with him, you know. You're for the high jump this time." A cunning look came over his face, and he answered immediately, "I'm not going to tell him the truth. I'm going to say that I suffer from loss of memory, and that I didn't know what I was doing or where I was." In due course, we escorted Smithy to be tried by the CO, and the following conversation ensued. But I won't be doing this in Australian as well. It's too challenging. CO, "Private Smith, you've been charged with absenting yourself without leave, etc., etc. What have you got to say for yourself?" Smithy, "I can't remember anything about it, sir. I suffer from loss of memory." "Oh, you do you? How do you know?" "Well, sir, things that I knew yesterday, I can no longer remember today." "But if you can't remember them today, how do you know that you knew them yesterday?" This introduction of irrefutable logic stalled Smithy for a few seconds. Then in desperation he said, "Well, sir, it's like this. I might be drinking with you in the wet canteen today, and I might reckon that you're a great bloke. But," and here he leaned forward towards the CO's desk, "tomorrow I might want to cut your bloody throat." The CO hastily ordered the RSM to remove Smithy from his office. Smithy was sent to the military hospital, where he was held in what I suppose would be called a psychiatric ward. I went to see him just before I left to come home, and we talked for some time about things in general. As I was leaving, he took me aside where no one else could hear, and he said, "I don't know why they've got me in this place. All the other blokes here are off their rockers." Not the real thing. We've all laughed at the British comedies produced after the war about their home defence units, known as the Home Guard. These units had been formed to take over guard duties from the regular army and to be a last line of defence in the event of an invasion. As depicted in the various comedies, they were comprised mostly of the aged and infirm who were physically unfit to serve. The series Dad's Army is a typical example. Because of the shortage of weapons in Britain, particularly after Dunkirk, these units could not be properly armed, and much of their training in the early days was done using broom handles in the place of rifles. In the country areas, the Home Guard armed themselves with various agricultural implements. This form of improvisation has been the source of much amusement to people who watch the TV shows, but I've no doubt that those who gave up their time to be in the Home Guard took it seriously. Many of them would have taken an active part in the First War. There were a few occasions during the war when we engaged in simulation exercises which were no less ridiculous than the humorous antics of make-believe soldiering portrayed in the films. Here are a couple of examples. It was generally believed in the early days of the war that concentrated small arms fire from the ground was effective against aircraft. I assume that the belief was based on the experiences of the First War, when aircraft were made from wood and cloth, flew close to the ground, and had a relatively low speed compared with modern aircraft. There was possibly some justification for this belief. For example, the famous German airman, Baron von Richthofen, the Red Baron, who seemed to have borne a charmed life in aerial combat, had finally been shot down by a machine gunner from the ground. We'd been trained to remain standing when attacked by aircraft and to fire in unison at them on the command of our officers. When marching on roads, we were usually in an open, staggered formation, with sections of 10 men on alternate sides of the road. In this formation, a battalion was spread out over a long section of the road. Periodically, the officers would announce that we were under air attack, whereupon we would stand where we were and raise our rifles to fire at the imaginary aircraft as directed by our officers. We didn't use ammunition, of course. To make the exercise more realistic, someone dreamed up the idea of having a small wooden model of an aeroplane mounted on a long stick carried by a running man. This would enable the men to aim at the aircraft and follow it as it moved. The operator would appear suddenly without warning from the bush on the side of the road, holding up the model and make... Oh, God, this gets better. Holding up the model and making a buzzing sound as he ran up and down from side to side through the columns of men, raising and lowering the stick as he ran. As can be imagined, the operator needed to be an uninhibited extrovert. It was difficult to find a volunteer prepared to do it. As the operator ran around us, the officer would call instructions such as "aircraft right" or "left" or "centre" as the case may be, followed by commands "load, aim, fire." That's how we were taught to deal with aircraft attacks in training. We were soon to find out that it would have been suicidal to do it in real life. About a year before the war ended, our brigade was doing invasion training at Trinity Beach near Cairns in Queensland. Trinity Beach was a popular swimming beach for the people of Cairns, probably because it was the nearest good beach with clean white sand. Cairns beaches seemed mostly to be black mud. The British naval supply ship HMS Glengyle was anchored in the bay for use as the mother ship for the invasion exercises. The unit during the actual training at the time lived on the ship for a few days. But as the ship could only accommodate one battalion at a time, the other two battalions were engaged on simulation training on land. To get from the mothership into the small assault craft, which would already be in the water alongside, it was necessary for the men to climb down rope landing nets on the ship side in the dark with all their equipment and weapons. This was one part of the training that could largely be simulated on land, and walls with nets attached had been constructed for this purpose. It wasn't possible, of course, to simulate the relative movements of the ship and the assault craft caused by wind and waves, but we did gain a lot of experience in climbing down nets. Each assault craft could carry 30 men in three rows of 10. It was flat-bottomed and had an armoured bow, which, when lowered, formed the ramp. The practice was to drive the assault craft towards the beach until it bottomed on the sand, then to drop the ramp. The men would leave the craft and spread out as they attacked across the sand. There'd been drownings when heavily laden men had fallen from the nets as they climbed down the ship's side in the dark. There was the possibility also that the assault craft could be sunk by enemy gunfire, or could unload the men into water that was above their heads. Our weapons, equipment and ammunition weighed at least 30 kilograms, and this was normally attached to us with straps and buckles. Falling into deep water with that weight was fatal. To reduce the risk of drowning, a system had been devised whereby all our equipment could be carried on the person securely, but could be quickly and easily jettisoned in an emergency. Our equipment remained in this safety mode from the time we started down the nets until the assault craft had reached water, in which theoretically at least one could stand. It didn't always happen that way. There were no spare assault craft for those who were doing simulation training on the land. To overcome this problem, outlines of assault craft were made at the water's edge by driving stakes into the sand and running a piece of string around them. When using these, we'd sit on the sand in three lines as we would in real boats. The platoon commander would scan the shore with his field glasses through an imaginary slot in the imaginary armoured bow. When it was decided that the imaginary water was shallow enough in which to stand, the officer would give the command, "Safe, water buckle your equipment and fix bayonets." The imaginary craft would beach, the imaginary ramp would drop down, and we'd fan out as we charged across the beach into the scrub on the foreshore. This exercise was repeated many times. As was the case in all our training, I'm sure that these simulation exercises had their value. At least we derived a lot of humour from them. The surroundings were pleasant and the work was much less arduous than some of the other things we did. I must say, however, that it was somewhat embarrassing for us in the circumstances. There's something farcical about fully grown, steel-helmeted, heavily armed men who've been at war for years to be playing these make-believe games in the midst of local families with their children enjoying a day at the beach. The children particularly were intrigued by our behaviour, standing around our boats so that they could see and hear it all. I've often wondered what the civilians thought of it at the time. Perhaps now when they look at Dad's Army on the TV, they think of us. Well, you might have guessed from the extended silence there that that's the end of the formal part of the show, though I should say there's plenty yet to come by way of the PS and with a final sign-off from Les, and also a further preview of the next episode about German boy soldier Willy Langbein. First, it's thank you time. Tony Trobe from Canberra wrote in absolutely ages ago about Les's memoirs, and I want to say a special thanks to Tony for getting it all together for me. He originally told me that Les had written many stories of his war experiences, mostly on the lighter side. And after around 70 stories and 5 episodes, I just wanted to reflect on Les's works after Tony sent in that vast zip file. He originally suggested I might like to cherry pick the best stories, but when it came down to it, they're all best. And how can anyone judge what people would enjoy? Because what might have had an element of everyday routine in it for one person is another person's historic gem. Regardless, I want to share some really great news with you. Really great. I've just been in touch with Tony to thank him for everything and to check out Les's health situation. And guess what? Well, in the words of the veteran Wolf Shaw, Les is still trespassing on this planet and doing very well by all accounts. Still riding a bike even. So I'm actually in the process of arranging to interview him, internet and COVID permitting. Tony said, Les is pretty compos mentis generally and an entertaining raconteur. And earlier this year, Les spent half an hour on video link having a nice chat with Princess Anne at the War Memorial. I believe she's the patron of the Royal Corps of Signals, and that was Les was closely associated with that. So, in view of all the above, if you have any questions you'd like me to put to Les or any comments about his memoirs or his service, please put them to me as soon as possible, and I'll try and include them. It might just be a word of thanks for his service and stories, but if you have any comments or questions, contact me via the website fightingthroughpodcast.co.uk, by email or voice message if you like. Personally, I've just loved the various moral messages that came out of this series, such as the lesson about bullying, leadership, sense of humour, and having a care about comrades. I've got many favourites, but the one which comes to mind instantaneously to me was the one where Les found that ancient coin in the desert, and not a gun or shell burst within sight or earshot. Probably second only to that would be the one about the oversized boots and Les's description of doing an about turn inside them without them moving. I'm going to be laughing my army socks off at that one for a long time to come. Talk about crying. So, without hesitation, the How Good Is That award for the first 6 months of 2021 goes to Les Cook's Memoirs of an Australian Soldier. How good is that? For you, Tommy, the war is over is an oft-heard phrase in wartime. For you, the war is over is about prisoners of war, their trials and tribulations of capture and escape, and it's produced by two guys called Dave and Dave. Now, following the sad passing of co-host Dave Harrison from COVID last year, the show was taken down, but I've just heard from Dave Robertson that it's going to be back from 7th of May 2021. The hosts are very well read on their subject and interact brilliantly while discussing the ins and outs of a particular escape. It's very engaging and definitely worth a listen. So make sure you're set up in your listening app and you won't miss what were the last 5 unpublished episodes of this series. And you'll also hear news of future plans for the show. So that's For You, The War Is Over, probably already in your feed. Thank you very much for your support and for making the time to listen to me. And by way of introducing the next episode, there's another suspenseful preview coming up about German soldier Willy Langbein. Did I say the next episode? Yes, you did, Paul. Oof, my word. In the previous episode, I gave you a preview of Heidi Langbein Allen's father's memoir of being a boy soldier in the German army. That's Wilhelm Johannes Langbein. Now, Heidi's trying to get the book published, and I'm very proud to be offering an exclusive preview of it in the Fighting Through Second World War podcast. And I've still got shivers up my spine from having shivers up my spine last week. So here goes with two more passages from the memoirs of Willy Langbein, Save the Last Bullet, Memoir of a Child Soldier in the Nazi Army. Here, Willy is in the early days of indoctrination into the army. One night, a kid from our group snuck into the SS depot and swiped some butter and ham. Nobody realised how different this act was from what we'd done before. The risk of being caught was always there, and we knew there would be a punishment. Perhaps we'd be beaten, made to perform menial chores, or not fed for a few days. But somehow, we still did it, because the stomach cramps were too painful to bear. But the SS played by different rules, and they were keeping watch. They caught the kid red-handed. It turned out that stealing from the SS carried the death penalty by firing squad. This is something we'd not known. Although rumours of their ruthless discipline abounded, the extent of the threat had not fully registered before. It's questionable if another outcome would ever have been possible, but early in 1945, any vestige of clemency was defunct and had long since given way to the increasingly erratic and violent behaviour of Hitler's forces. And now back to the fighting. Listen, at the Sturmgewehr mentioned in this next passage is an assault rifle. It's a real beast of a weapon. There are YouTube videos galore if you want to choose one, but I've put a photo of one in the show notes. The Russians came closer. I scrambled out of the hall and shot at the grenadiers with my pistol, but I ran out of ammunition and was left with just one last bullet. I had a moment of indecision. Now what? Suddenly, there was a Russian in front of me. He pointed his bayonet and thrust it towards my belly. I quickly grabbed my Sturmgewehr, which was slung over my shoulder, and shoved it at his bayonet, blocking it. I'm such a tease, aren't I? If you want to know what happens next, you know what you've got to do. I really can't wait to get this next episode out to you. Heidi and I have discussed how much and what material to use, and it's even possible it's going to end up being two episodes. You're going to learn about young Willy's upbringing, his war, and his proud later life successes. I've been lucky enough to read the entire book, and it really is an eye-opener at many levels. So hear more in episode 69, and no matter how long it takes, it will be soon. P.S. Go on then, here's another story from our favourite Aussie man Les. And look out for PS2 as a final sign-off to this episode. This one's called The Mailed Fist. Listener, I just love the many parallels we've uncovered between Les Cook's war and not only several of the passages in the Fighting Through podcast, but also Dad's book, Fighting Through from Dunkirk to Hamburg. So to get this PS underway, I'm going to read a passage from Dad's book about flamethrowers. It's set in Normandy on D-Day, and Dad and his comrades are advancing through the French countryside. It was not just a matter of walking along country lanes, because there was no shortage of enemy activity. One of our main objectives about noon was a rocket site, which was hidden in a wood about 3 miles inland. Heavy, intensive machine gun fire was directed towards us from here, and as the wood was isolated, we couldn't get near it. They seemed to be making a real effort to harass us, and in order to avoid any loss of life, our CO called up support. It came in the form of a Churchill tank. At a later date, when the RAF had airfields in Normandy, a typhoon would quickly have been on the scene. Anyway, on this day the tank advanced towards the wood and soon came under anti-tank fire, and since it was not hit, it retaliated, as quick as a flash. It stopped about 40 yards from me, and before you could bat your eyes, whoosh, it threw a huge tongue of flame towards the wood, doing so three times. Flaming Germans came running out from all sides with their hands up. The ones who survived were taken prisoner. Needless to say, the opposition ceased, enabling us to now move forward. Whew. Okay, that was Dad in France on D-Day. This is Les in Indonesia. We went to Celebes soon after the war ended to oversee the surrender of the Japanese forces there. We were in the capital, Makassar, for a few weeks, then part of the battalion moved to the village of Pare Pare on the coast about 160 kilometres north of Makassar. In addition to rounding up the Japanese troops preparatory to sending them to Japan, arrangements were made to bring in the supplies that had been stored in their depots in the hills. The food was needed not only to feed the prisoners, but also the local population. It was a time of political unrest in Indonesia. A nationalist movement was growing, the more militant members of which were preparing for the struggle to free their country from the control of the Dutch. Many had armed themselves with Japanese weapons, and they were themselves setting up camps in the hills. This was a political matter, and as such, we were not to involve ourselves unless security was threatened. Bringing in the food supplies had been decreed to be a civilian responsibility. We had no direct part in it. It wasn't long before the gangs forming in the hills started to steal the rice from the trucks bringing it into town. To overcome this problem, armed local guards accompanied each convoy, but this only had a temporary effect. Soon the rice, the trucks, and the guards all disappeared. Something had to be done. A patrol under the command of the colonel visited all the nearby villages to search for the missing rice and to make it clear that the thefts were incurring our displeasure. Speaking through an interpreter, the colonel explained the purpose of our visit and asked the chief of each village if he knew anything about it. In every case, he received the same answer. The people of that particular village were honest above reproach, but the people of the next village were notorious thieves who'd steal from their own grandmothers. We were no nearer to solving the problem at the end of the patrol than we had been when we started, and the rice continued to disappear. The colonel then decided to invite the chiefs of the nearby villages to a party in Pare Pare. The gathering was held on a patch of grassland on the outskirts of the village. While fish was plentiful and cheap, meat of any kind had been in short supply throughout the war and was much sought after by the locals. Our cooks had prepared large quantities of bully beef stew, which was eaten by the guests with great delight. The colonel had arranged a demonstration of battalion arms to entertain the guests after the feast. The vicar's machine guns fired traces so they would be visible. The 2 and 4.2-inch mortars fired smoke and explosives, and the 6-pounder anti-tank guns fired at a target. The chiefs were visibly impressed with this demonstration of conventional arms. But the colonel's pièce de résistance was his finale, with the flamethrowers. Loaded with thin fuel, the flamethrower discharges a flame about 25 metres long by 3 metres wide. This is accompanied by a loud roaring sound. 6 of these weapons, spaced at 5 metre intervals, were lined up one end of the cleared area, and on the word of command, all 6 fired simultaneously. With an impressive roar, a wall of orange-red flame and oily black smoke engulfed the whole area for a few seconds, leaving a carpet of burnt grass. It was an awe-inspiring display, even for us. Before the smoke had cleared away, and while the mouths of the chiefs were still open with wonder, the colonel stood up and thanked them for attending his party. He ended his short speech by asking for their cooperation in ensuring that the thefts of rice would stop. to the best of my knowledge, we didn't lose a grain of rice thereafter. This event is recorded briefly in the official war history, The Final Campaign, by Gavin Long, page 576. I've been thinking for some while about what story I could use for a PS in this last episode of the series. I think we've been massively entertained by the light-hearted slant that Les Cook put on most of his stories, so much so that there's a danger we might forget the peril that these brave Australian soldiers continually fought under. So, to finish off, I'm going to end on a slightly more serious note, and I'm going to return to the sentiments we heard Les express in the very first episode, 64. And here's just a shortened version of that, and my goodness, I think we all have something to learn from it. Nations have passed away and left no traces, and history gives the naked cause of it. The single simple reason, in all cases, they fell because their peoples were not fit. When Rudyard Kipling wrote these lines, I believe he was referring to the strength of moral character of a people, not to their physical fitness, however important the latter undoubtedly is. The character of a people is developed and tempered in the fire of adversity. History shows only too clearly that it can be diminished or indeed changed altogether in times of peace and plenty such as we now enjoy, when there no longer appears to be any need to aspire to the high ideals on which it was built. Most of us perceive that there's an Australian national character. We believe that it embodies the good in a people and are quietly proud of it. If we're to retain this character, however, we must not neglect to uphold the memory and extol the virtues of those whose exemplary deeds and dauntless courage are at its very foundation. This brings us back to the story of Corporal John Arthur Metson of the 12th of the 14th Australian Infantry Battalion, which was sent to New Guinea in August 1942 to stem the Japanese overland advance on Port Moresby. With his ankle smashed by a bullet, John Metson was one of many cut off in the jungle when, after 4 days of bitter fighting, the Japanese broke through the Australian defence line in the Owen Stanley Range, south of Kokoda in Papua New Guinea. Although badly wounded himself, he gathered together others around him and led them through the jungle with the objective of rejoining the battalion. The group fell in with a much larger party under the command of Captain S.H. Buckler, which also had been cut off, and stretchers were made to carry the wounded. John Metson said that he'd crawl on his hands and knees, asking only that his hands and knees be bandaged to protect them from the stones and sharp sticks on the rough tracks. With the group desperately short of food and getting weaker each day, a main party left the wounded at Sangay and pushed on with all the speed it could muster to get help. A stretcher-bearer, Corporal Tom Fletcher, volunteered to stay with them to care for the wounded. Before leaving Sangay, Captain Butler drew up the party in formation and presented arms in salutation to those being left behind. They were not to see each other again. A ground patrol visiting the village a month later found the bodies of Tom Fletcher and the wounded men. Unarmed and unable to defend themselves, they'd been murdered. An award of the British Empire Medal was made to John Metson after his death in recognition of his outstanding courage, unselfishness and exemplary willpower. When you stand in silent remembrance on Anzac Day, or when you stand before a cenotaph on the gates of a war cemetery and read the words, "Their name liveth forevermore," think of John Metson, of his fortitude, his determination not to be a burden to others, and his cheerful acceptance of the awful situation into which he'd been thrust. We have a responsibility to future generations to do everything we can to keep alive the spirit of John Metzen and people like him. People who in times of extreme adversity did not lose heart, but pressed on gallantly and cheerfully towards the goal against all odds, placing the welfare of others above their own, and leaving us with a tradition of which we all should feel justifiably proud. If as a people we can keep this spirit alive, and if each of us individually do our best to live up to their example, we shall be fit. I'm Paul Cheel saying bye-bye now.